Welcome to Fresh Take, your favorite weekly podcast that delivers a healthy dose of information pertaining to healthy lifestyles, organic and sustainable agriculture, and numerous topics related to the environment. Thanks for tuning in. Our industry experts are here to provide you with a fresh take on topics that can help you optimize your lifestyle and well-being. Welcome to Fresh Take. On today's episode, we will be discussing genetically modified organisms. I have very special guests with me today. I have Dr. Stephen Forbes, and I have Dr. Ramakrishnan, who is the CEO and ED. Stephen, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Okay, thank you, Jessica, for having me. So a little bit about myself. I did my bachelor's in microbiology, then went from there and got my PhD in biomedical science. I spent some time working in vaccine design evaluation and immunology and with molecular genetics.
Wonderful. I'm glad to have an expert on our panel today to discuss this topic. Dr. Ramakrishnan, can you tell us a little bit about yourself as well?
Thank you very much. I do have a PhD, but my PhD is not as expertise or subject matter specialist like Stephen is here. What I'm here today is to bring the perspective from the organic world and how we see the GMOs in the context of the organic world.
Well, we definitely appreciate both of you being here today. So in a previous episode, we talked a little bit about genetically modified organisms, but today we'd really like to get a little more in depth and provide you, our consumer, with more information on what genetically modified organisms are and how it's done. So, Stephen, I'm going to let you take the lead on this and give our listeners a little bit of an education on what are genetically modified organisms.
Okay, so kind of the basics. So a genetically modified organism would be an organism that's been genetically engineered or genetically modified. And what that means is whether it's a virus, a bacteria, a plant, mammal, that a modification has been made to the encoding material. So a DNA or an RNA, which then is the coding sequence that gives rise to the proteins which are the functional and the traits.
Okay, now so, Stephen, I know a lot of our listeners probably understand DNA. Can you explain RNA?
So RNA is very similar to DNA.
Okay.
And in, say humans and mammals, RNA would be a product of transcription, where it's an intermediary form that's used before a protein is made.
Okay.
So DNA is a coding sequence, the RNA is the message, and then you get the protein made from the message.
Okay, very good. That makes sense.
To wrap up things here, the term biotechnology, genetically modified organisms, genetic engineering, for most part is used synonymous. A lot of people misunderstand. There are some subtle differences between each of them, but for today's function, for today's discussion, we're going to be just talking as if it's all one terminology. Piggybacking on what Stephen was talking about, the difference between RNA and DNA, the fundamental materials that everybody has is the DNA with its response, that's the genetic code. And RNA is, like Stephen was talking about, it's an intermediary stuff. But when we talk about in the GMO context, it becomes very important because viruses, which is one of the organisms that is used to make genetically modified organisms, typically has an RNA. So okay. Bacteria and other higher forms of life has DNA.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. Well, Stephen, how is this done? I mean, how does this all work?
Okay, so if we simplify the process down, essentially what you want to do in these contexts is you want to move a trait. This is desirable from one, say, organism to another.
Okay.
If that approach, if you've mapped out where that sequence is, you know the sequence, you can move that sequence into a vector and to a vehicle that will allow you to move it into the other host, into the other species often. Okay. So how this is accomplished, essentially, at the very basic level, you cut out an element you want. So if a sequence that will encode the protein.
Okay.
And you'll move it over.
Okay.
In plants, this is often accomplished by moving into what was referred to as a plasmid. It's a circular element. It's like taking if you take the piece from, say, a vanilla donut and you make a nick in a chocolate donut and insert it, you've now created your vector that can move over and then insert into, say, another type of donut.
Right.
We use a donut analogy.
Very good.
You're moving elements around. in plants, the actual moving into the host where you want it expressed is often accomplished by bacteria, by Agrobacterium, which is a natural pathogen of plant and has a mechanism, actually a molecular syringe that'll allow it to inject
into
this vector and move it over to allow it to insert and then create your genetically modified organism.
Wow, that's very complex.
Stephen, am I understanding this right? Correct me if I'm wrong. The process of how GMO is done is probably a 3 or 4 step process, just simplified, vastly simplified. It's a lot more than that. Say, for example, I'm particularly interested in a rust component from a plant. And so I've identified the trait, rust resistance, as one of the criteria. Now, then I go back to the lab and do a sequence of the genetic material, which is the DNA. Basically, sequences, basically, as you most of the viewers may know, or may know, that the DNA is made up of nucleotides. There are five different types of nucleotides.
Four common.
Okay.
And the fifth one is...
there's another form used in RNA, which would be your fifth.
Yeah. So there is four common nucleotides that gets arranged. Depending on... So each trait is associated with those arrangement, becomes the gene responsible for the protein production. So the expression of protein is an indicator that a particular trait is associated with a particular trait, because that's how traits are being expressed when the genes gets activated. So just to circle back and going even further down, so what once we identify the trait, like rust resistance or herbicide resistance, then the scientist goes back to the lab, does the sequence, plot, takes the genetics, DNA, do some analysis, understand the sequence, and say, okay, this, and then finally identify that sequence, the nucleotide, or the four forms of commonly occurring nucleotides, and say, it could be arranged in A, it could be arranged, and they identify that particular sequence in the lab, and they do the mapping first, and sequence them, and then the mapping first, and identify the particular trait that is responsible for that rust resistant, and then that's step one. Step 10 is actually copying it. Because it is done in the lab, it's in the computer. How are you going to do it? So you can do it two possible ways. Either is synthesis of that. You take that sequence. Can we replicate in the lab? Synthesize the same sequence in the lab. We have advanced so much that is possible. That is one way to do it.
Okay.
That is the synthesis part. And the synthesis of the particular trait in the lab. Or, good old days, they actually go and do the actual gene editing part. They know they go to the actual plant, live plant, or in this case, the rust resistant part, and they were able to take out the particular. There are some sophisticated technologies that's far more beyond what I can understand, and they're able to do that precisely. Cut the gene. They know this gene. They have identified this trait. It's associated with this gene. They cut the gene, take the gene out, and then they are able to move it to the host plant. But here, this going back, step two is synthesis of. So there's two ways to do it. We're talking about synthesis. So they synthesis in the lab. Then once they're the synthesis, then they move it to what I call as using the vector, the donut example you used, an excellent example that you used there as an analogy. Why donuts example is because commonly used is, you know, you have to take the one that is synthesis.
Right.
And you need to have a living things because now it's almost like it has no life. The synthesized gene has no life. It has to be attached to a live animal. Or live vector.
A living organism.
We use the word vector. People commonly use this vector. So you attach this vector. You have to attach to the vector. And the commonly used vector is Agrobacterium. Stephen rightfully said, the Agrobacterium is a bacteria, and it's the workhorse right now.
Right.
And the Agrobacterium, there are different strains of Agrobacterium, different, but each one is different. So this Agrobacterium has the ability that can act like a syringe. It can go and attach into the host plant, which is whichever the plant we want to transfer the particular trait, like rust resistant. It has a unique ability. So that's why they're using Agrobacterium. Can we use other vectors? Yes. RNAs, viruses, and other vector that we can typically use. We're going to talk about, Stephen knows a lot more about virus than I do, and some of the implications. So the step three is actually transformation using a vector into the plant, right. Into the host cells.
To the host, okay.
So the host cell transformation happens in the lab. So once the transformation is done, then you do a little bit of tissue culture And then once the tissue culture is done, the plants, then you have a plant and you do some testing. You want to make sure whatever you transferred is actually as transferred.
Right.
The challenging part for a genetist or molecular biologist or genetic engineers is, you know, when you transfer it, it's not like precise. In order for a particular trait to express itself, you have to use in a lot of cells because you have to have certain volume of this gene particle attaching to the cells. So in the lab, they test it. They have controls. They have markers. They have other stuff, and they make sure this is working. Hey, did it really got transferred? And say, for example, you transferred this in the lab condition for 200 cells.
Right.
This transfers this gene to 100 cells. And they would do the testing. And you say, for example, it is a rust resistant. You pour the rust spores in those cells. I'm just simplifying again. And then only 10 of them survives. All other 90. That means 90 of them did not get the gene. Only 10 of them are able to express it. You isolate the 10 cells, culture them further to tissue culture process, and identify, come up with plantlets. And then you go with the traditional modern breeding, traditional breeding techniques to go with that. Am I articulating this very well, Stephen?
You're hitting on the high points there. It definitely helps if they do use a marker for selection, if there is something to select on. Screening is a lengthy process, though. You're talking about saying 100. In reality, these recombination frequencies are much, much lower.
Yep.
So it's definitely easier to stand, say, with 100 as opposed to talking in the millions here. But
yes, yeah. Yes, you're right. I was just simplifying things.
Yeah.
Wow, this is a lot of information. And for me, I think, and our consumers and our listeners as well, you guys have really taken us to a place where we can fully understand what's going on. And what concerns me is, so this is happening with our food. And I know that there's a list of food that it's been genetically modified. Can you talk a little bit about that and let us know what's going on with our food that we're buying on a regular basis?
So that's interesting. So there's several places you can find lists. One is with the USDA Agricultural Marketing Service. Under the National Bioengineered Food Disclosure Standard, on their webpage with that, they actually list the bioengineered foods the U.S. is now going to require to be labeled in the future.
Okay.
And those include alfalfa, specific variety of apple, canola, corn, cotton, eggplant, again, a particular variety, papaya, pineapple, potato. We also get soybean, squash, and sugar beet. There actually is a salmon listed on that list as well.
Oh, wow.
But some of these are like whole crops, like corn and soy. There's many varieties available.
Right.
And the USDA does provide some resources you can link out and see what they're looking for and what should be labeled. In the future, that is. And some of these are very specific varieties. Like there's only one apple variety listed on the list.
Okay.
The European Union also maintains a list as well.
Okay.
So different government agencies maintain lists. But the ones I've focused on there are particular to this new National Bioengineered Food Disclosure Standard.
When is that going to happen, Stephen? What's the date? What's the time range for this when the labeling will be required?
Okay, so the implementation date right now is January 1 of 2020, except for small food manufacturers. They have an implementation date of January 1, 2021. The mandatory compliance date is January 1, 2022. So there's some time still.
There's some time.
Yeah.
There's some time. Do you feel like, I mean, what are the, are there advantages to genetically modified organisms in our food? Is there anything that you can help us understand with that?
But before we jump into the advantages, I do wanted to go back, circle back with
absolutely
list of GM foods. Stephen gave an exhaustive list, and this list is available on the USDA's website. And if you search for National Bioengineered Food Disclosure Standard, and they have on their website a list of crops that has genetically modified. However, this is not specific to just the crops Stephen has talked about, because a lot of this crops is used as an ingredient in several processed food. I'll use an example: cornstarch. Corn syrup is used in quite a lot of food.
Corn syrup is in everything these days.
And soy
is another one. Thanks, Stephen. So you know, it may appear to be just few crops, but the implication on further processed food or value added food, these ingredients are used in a lot, both corn and soybean, a lot more than other crops here. Just want to let you know that there is other products that may be involved.
Well, because as it stands right now, when we go to purchase food and we're looking, you know, okay, we don't want to buy anything that's genetically modified, or we want to know what's going on with it. So chances are a lot of what we buy has products in it that have been modified, and we won't know it.
Yeah. And there's a good chance a product out there containing corn would be GMO corn.
Okay. That makes sense. Thank you, Ramakrishnan, for elaborating a little bit more on that.
Should probably throw a caveat in there, unless it's organic certified corn, because GMO is not allowed there.
Good to know. So we should be looking for organic products. Very good.
That's a great tip. That's a great tip there.
Absolutely. Thanks. So
going back to Advantage, you and I have been talking about some things. Can you want to share some of those stuff?
There's a reason people would approach genetic engineering to crops. Mm-hmm. It is a way to move, to produce a variety much faster than traditional breeding.
Right.
If you can move, a single gene to confer a trait for, say, resistance. It's also a way to move an element that normally you wouldn't be able to cross through traditional breeding.
Okay.
And I think we're going to have an example of that coming up later when we discuss citrus.
I echo what Stephen has said. Traditional breeding is crossing two varieties. I will use an example here. Everybody knows mustard. How many of us know that how many traits of mustard is now we are seeing in cabbage, cauliflower, broccoli, because they are related species? There are several desired traits from mustard is now transferred from traditional breeding into those crops. This happened through traditional breeding techniques. When you do a traditional breeding, it's very hard for a breeder to know. So, you know, traditional breeding goes with the old concept of Mendelian genetics concept. You know, you have two varieties, you breed, you're hoping that it is going to produce, the hybrid is going to produce, you cross a tall and a short variety.
Right.
The resulting variety is going to come into 3:1 ratio. That's the three with the dominant gene and one with the recessive gene kind of thing. So what GM has helped, like Stephen articulated, is it was time-consuming. It was a lot of expense involved. What the scientists were able to do that is going back and say, I like this rust resistance. I like this herbicide resistance. Instead of involving so much energy, instead of involving so much resources, I can now go back. It's going peeling one level back.
Okay.
I can go one level down back, and I'm precisely able to identify this particular gene that is responsible for that particular character or trait. Now, I can transfer it easily, and there is an enormous amount of time. And like Stephen said, I completely agree with you, Stephen. One of the biggest advantage is now we are able to look at genes, desired gene traits or character from species which would have been not possible before. That's the brilliance of science. Salute to all those scientists who made this possible. You know, innovations and creativity is responsible for it.
Absolutely. Now, Stephen, I heard you mention something about citrus a moment ago. What's going on with our citrus?
So, a lot's been going on with citrus, but okay. Something particularly that's been out recently is there's been essentially a petition for a permit to use a genetically engineered citrus tristata virus that would, the goal with this would be to use it as a vector to confer a protein from spinach, which might help prevent problems associated with citrus greening.
Okay.
As you know, citrus greening. Citrus is a very important crop for the state of Florida.
Yes, it is.
If next to cattle operation, citrus is the second largest ag-based industry in the state. It's a very important livelihood for several of our farmers in our state, and it's a very important crop. Everybody loves oranges in November and December. It's a season year, especially fresh oranges. So what was happening is the citrus greening disease. This is wiping out a lot of our groves. The citrus greening disease is actually caused by an insect called psyllid. The insect psyllid, it's like mosquito biting you.
Yes.
Mosquito can transfer West Nile virus and other stuff. So the psyllid actually comes and it's a sucking pest. And when I say sucking pest, means it applies its saliva and sucks the juice sap out of the plants. And when it does the sapping out of the plants, very similar to mosquito, it transfers this bacterial disease. It's called citrus greening. The plant, you lose the entire grow. Once it's infected, you get to take out the grow out. Florida has lost enormous amount of citrus groves because of this. It is estimated that close to $3.4 billion is being spent or lost because of the citrus greening disease every year. So what Stephen is talking about is a new initiative to have genetically modified variety that will be resistant to the citrus greening disease. Yes. But there are some mild differences. Go ahead,
Jay. Yeah, so it's quite interesting in this aspect because what they've want to do is not is a measure in between the measures they're taking now trying to prevent the spread of the disease, and there's talk of trying to introduce genetically engineered trees. In this case, what they're proposing is engineering a virus that won't pass along that trait to the tree itself, but will infect the tree, and then that trait will be expressed during infection. So it won't modify the tree's DNA.
Okay.
So that's genetic modification of a virus to confer the trait. Ultimately, some of the talk is about modifying the trees themselves, but this would be a in-between measure.
Okay.
Steve and I was talking about it a little bit later this morning. He and I was reading a paper together published from USDA, and the scientist himself who designed the design used a similar technique before. To draw some parallel here, this method they're using, it is very slightly different than a typical GM corn, genetically modified corn that you see in the market.
Mm-hmm.
This technique you can compare with, correct me if I'm wrong, Stephen, we're talking about like FluMist. This technique, as an intermediate step, what they're trying to do is, in FluMist, you take a virus, basically, and then you use the term attenuation, which means that it is made it as, it is still live, but it is not potent. It's not virulent. And then you have the FluMist, and your body is producing a reaction unable to withstand. If you get infection, the body is producing a reaction, meaning it produces antibodies to be able to withstand if you get infected. So the same idea is used here
with this
genetic engineered citrus. Say they, like Steven said, they're using a virus to inoculate, to bring introduce to this tree, the actual trees. And the trees will act very similar to humans. If they get citrus greening bacteria, the bacteria that's responsible for causing the disease, the tree will be able to produce enough thing, or the virus being able to produce enough stuff to be able to withstand the disease.
So it'll boost the immunity of the tree, essentially.
Exactly. Down the road, like Stephen mentioned, they may be plans to act. So there is no genetic modification of here. There's no genetic modification.
Right.
It's like it's a step in between, like Stephen actually said.
Okay, that's really interesting.
So Stephen, what do you thought about? You know, I'm just curious, and having read many papers about viruses, you know, we used, as I mentioned before in our conversation in the podcast, that we talked about, hey, why bacteria being a workhorse and like Agrobacterium being a workhorse, which is one of the bacteria always used and mostly used. And we talked about virus. What do you think about virus as a vector to transform for transformation process?
For transformation? So most commonly, as we were saying, we would see Agrobacterium as bacteria. And the reasons for it's a natural pathogen of plants, and it already has a way to inject DNA, allow it to integrate into the host and express things. Viruses, on the other hand, often you're going to see limitations in host range. Agrobacterium has a very broad host range. I mean, it can infect many things. And with viral infection, and actually, unless it integrates into the DNA, so unless it itself integrates for the trait, it's likely to be short-lived.
Mm-hmm.
With the virus we're talking about here, the CTV virus, it's actually an RNA virus, and they tend to be less stable. And you can get reversion back to the wild type. So it'll be interesting to see as far as stability and expression levels, what they can get, if this can be transient, or if they can actually produce the levels they're thinking they can.
Okay. I think, if I'm not mistaken, there was a recent, USDA has opened up public comments again because there was a recent study that led to the belief that, to summarize what Stephen was talking about, is when you use virus as a vector, in this case, like for the G citrus, what was happening here is, as Stephen mentioned, virus can easily revert back to its original form, which is from the less virulent form to a more potent form, causing more damage than what was supposed to be. So the USDA had recently had a recent scientific publication about this particular virus that is used for the citrus industry. And they have opened up the public comment because of, well, that is because of two reasons. One is, is this virus stable? Can it revert back into to the more virulent form? That means it's going to cause more damage than can. And is it if it is virulent, is it going to spread to other growths that is not even injected with this virus for as a test basis? So that's the concern. That's why they are opening up.
Yeah, the, really comes down to transmissibility and can it cross with other circulating forms of this virus in wild-type form.
Yeah, that's why every year the flu vaccines get updated with the new strains because of the ability of the virus, especially the RNA, to evolve and mutate itself into new forms.
Yeah, RNA will mutate at a faster rate than DNA.
Yeah, and that may that's the concern. That's why they're opening up.
Absolutely.
The future remains to be seen about how this is going to be efficient. But historically, correct me if I'm wrong, Stephen, when we use virus as a vector, they're not stable in the environment for a long period of time. So it remains to be seen how effective this genetically engineered citrus is going to withstand citrus screening.
So it sounds to me like there's going to be a lot of testing involved to see what happens and where we go next.
We'll see. Right now it's a public comment period. I don't know about testing, so here is an opportunity for people. If they want to make a public comment, it's open. You can search for USDA public comments. In Google, you can search for USDA public comments G citrus virus permit. So you can make public comment one way or other, supporting it, or if you don't like it, you can also make a public comment. But it remains to be seen how this all works out.
Very good. This is, like I said, this is a lot of information for us to really digest and process. Like I was saying a minute ago, it sounds to me like there's still a lot of testing that needs to be done, and clearly a lot of testing has been done previously to even get this information. And what is done in order to gather all of this information so they know what to do? How do they fight the greening? What steps are taken?
I will answer the question and let Stephen to expand on what I'm saying. GM testing, I think there's two kinds of testing here you're talking about. The process of releasing a variety that is genetically modified is different. That's one kind of thing you're talking about.
Right.
The other process is, as a consumer, how do I know my product has genetically modified organisms or not?
Right.
That's the second question. I'm dividing into two parts, and I'm going to talk about the first part about the process of testing before a particular genetically modified organism is released. Usually, USDA has established a well-standardized process. So a lot of these varieties that you have seen here, what Stephen was talking about in the beginning, has gone through those processes. The process is public, and it is available through public to see what kind of steps is involved to get your particular variety to be approved by USDA to be released as genetically modified organisms. It's a pretty standardized process. The part about how do I know my product has GMO, what kind of test is available, I am going to defer to the expertise of Stephen because I don't know. Stephen?
So the most commonly used test, if you send a sample out to the lab and ask them a test for a GMO variety, would be a PCR-based test. So a polymerase chain reaction where you look for an element, so a GMO marker, by actually amplifying that region. So it's a very specific form of testing, and you can do it in either a qualitative or a quantitative manner. So you can actually get a percentage out, and it is dependent very much on what you are looking for. It is very targeted. So if you're looking for a promoter element or a gene, that's what you're going to get the result back on. It's not a broad test. It has to be tailored to exactly what you're looking for.
So PCR is the test. How much it costs?
PCR testing? Commercial tests, probably in the $200 to $400 range.
Oh wow, kind of expensive.
Yes, it is.
Yeah, which is why Florida Organic Growers has just taken a position that consumers should have a choice, and products
Absolutely.
That contains GMO should be labeled, and GMO labeling is important, and that's how we feel that GMO labeling should be encouraged. The industry should come together and start labeling the products as genetically modified. Stephen, you want to add more about the U.S. labeling requirements and the European Union and other stuff?
Well, actually, Rom, it's very interesting that you brought that up. That leads me to today's fresh fact. Did you all know that, I'm sure you all know, but our listeners don't, that 64 countries or more, over half of the world, actually require labeling on their products if they've been genetically modified. Right. It's really discouraging that here in the States, that's not a requirement.
It is a requirement. I just want to point out what Stephen was talking about here. The new National Bioengineered Food Disclosure Standard, it's based on an, requires you to label, but it could have been a little bit more elaborate, robust.
Absolutely.
That's what our feeling is, because there are a lot of exemptions and exclusions, but it is a first step. You know, this is a first step. So it's going in the right direction.
Yeah, I do notice in my shopping when I'm looking at different products that I see products that are labeled GMO-free, which is encouraging that, you know, it does let us know if they don't contain genetically modified organisms, but there's no labeling in place for those that do contain them. So if you could talk about a little bit about that, Stephen, that'd be great.
So, yeah, that's interesting. To first address your one point, there are a number of third-party verifications that companies can go to get their products a seal or certified as GMO-free.
Right.
And as far as labeling, it's interesting. The European Union already has a law in effect concerning labeling of GMO or GMO-containing products. And there's actually a threshold associated with that one. If it's over 0.9% GMO in the product, it needs to be declared as such.
Then it requires a label.
Then it requires to be labeled as containing GMO or made from GMO.
And European Union has an exhaustive list and a little bit more robust than our U.S. regulations are. Am I correct, Stephen?
It appears to be, yeah. They actually have a fairly extensive list of the GM varieties they recognize and what the genes are. It's available on there with the regulations.
Yeah. I think, like I said it before, Jessica, we are heading in the right direction.
We're absolutely.
With the National Bioengineered Food Disclosure Standard, which requires certain products to be labeled, not all products, but some products. It's a good start. Hopefully we'll get to where we need to go, because FOG's position, Food Organics' position, is, you know, consumers should have a choice, and they should be labeled accordingly, and consumer can make the choice whether to buy a product that has GMO or not to buy a product with GMO.
Absolutely. Well, I think that both of you have provided a great deal of information to our listeners, and I thank you for joining us today. As always, I'm your host, Jessica Stipe. I'm the Education and Outreach Director for Florida Organic Growers. If you like our podcast, we encourage you to continue listening. Please log on to our website at foginfo.org, where you can click on the podcast button at the top. It'll lead you to our page, and we encourage you to please go on and make a tax-deductible donation so we can continue bringing you this podcast. You can also leave comments for us in that section and suggestions on future episodes. Thank you for listening. Thank you guys for listening to today's episode. I hope you guys enjoyed the conversation as much as we did. As many of you already know, FOG is a 501c3 not-for-profit organization, which means we need your help to keep all of our content free to the public. Please consider making a tax-deductible donation today. We would really appreciate your support.